I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. All the talk here is about getting up to speed on the new Latin America, the talkback, dare we say, uppity neo-socialist Latin America. We will see it face-to-face in a fortnight or so in a meeting of some real consequence. Evo Morales, the populist president of Bolivia, is coming to Brown toward the end of February, the first leader in Latin America of indigenous stock, of pre-Columban roots, so to speak, will be making his first ever campus visits in the United States. We're getting our heads ready. The all-day conferences this week are on changes in the Andes, most especially Venezuela, Ecuador, and Bolivia. Sujatha Fernandez, a sociologist from Queens College at the City University of New York. You were talking this morning about cultural aspects of this change. If all we had to go by were the popular radio, the music, the poetry, the novels, the fiction, the fantasy of Latin America, what would we judge about it? Leaving aside the economics and the politics, what are the artists telling us?
Well, I think when we go to the fiestas populares, the popular fiestas, or the community media, one of the things that you notice is just how very local people's concerns are. And I think when you have President Hugo Chavez saying, oh, you know, we want to make this continent-wide Bolivarian revolution, and talking in these very grand terms about the kind of broad-scale global change that he wants to bring about, and then you go into one of these barrios and you listen to the concerns on the community radio, and they're talking about, you know, we're still having problems because our drains haven't been clean and we've got black water here, and they're talking about things that concern their neighborhood, that concern their community. At times, these neighborhoods are very small. They might be, you know, 20 houses along a small stretch of road, and the neighbors have the vecinos, which is what they call each other. They have a community radio station to talk about everything going on in their community. And they're talking about the person that lives next door. They're using the names of the references of, you know, the behind the basketball court. This is what they're saying on the radio. And you realize that their frame of reference, despite the fact that they're living this momentous era, is, and what is, I feel, the strength of this process, is how much it is based in the local and how much it's also based in history. And again, President Chavez uses these terms like Simón Bolívar and all the Francisco de Miranda, and he'll consistently bring up these different heroes and grand heroes and construct these narratives about everything that happens. So during the recall referendum, which was a referendum that the opposition wanted to do to get Chavez out of power by collecting signatures, through all of these things, he invokes the Batalla de Santa Inés, or, you know, the Battle of Santa Inés. He's always invoking history. And again, you see history being important when you listen to the community radio or you see the popular fiestas, but it's a very different kind of history. It's the history of, they're talking about the counter-heroes. They're talking about Negro Primero. They're talking about Huaycaipuro. They're talking about,
what does that mean?
Often Negro Primero and Huaycaipuro are people who were mythical heroes from the time of the independence struggle, but they're kind of counter-heroes. They're people who are not always celebrated in the official discourse. They're people who are often subterranean characters who have remained active in the popular memory and the popular imagination through oral storytelling and through passing down of these myths and legends, but not so much. And there's a racial difference as well. Simón Bolívar is often presented as this Creole, or he was a Creole Republican leader of the landed oligarchy, whereas, you know, these people from the Negro Primero was black, was Afro-Venezuelan. Huaycaipuro was indigenous. And so you see, when you go down to this local level, the kinds of histories that are being remembered and recalled are often very different kinds of histories to what you find in the official realm.
Who knew that Venezuela had community radio? I mean, we know the presidential face on television, but where does the community radio idea come from? And what does it tell you?
Well, community radio is something that has been gathering steam globally for quite a while now, and it came from people with megaphones on the corner of the street about 15, 20 years ago, just making announcements at the side of the metro station. And that's how it began. And it's when people began to get the technology of low-power radio and low-power transmitters that they began to set up these small radio stations. And what's quite extraordinary is how they draw on technology, even in a very poor barrio where people don't even often have enough to put food on the table, how this very, you know, they'll sit on someone's bed, they'll have their microphone on the table, and they'll have their transmitter. And with this very basic technology, they'll have guests who'll come in and sit on the woman's bed as well. You know, this is the kind of low-scale thing that I've seen in people doing radio with. And that's how it began to spread. And you had, you know, a lot of people interested in doing it once they found out. And when I say technology, text messages is very important in this. So you'll have somebody on the air and they'll be receiving text messages from the listeners. And they'll say, oh, such and such is calling in now. They're saying this. Oh, someone else is saying, say hi to their mother, wish the sister a happy birthday. There's always all of this kind of messages and information coming in. And it draws very much on this technology of cell phones, which, you know, weren't available 15, 20 years ago for a person who lived in the barrio. But now all of this technology is coming together, this low-power technology, to create new kind of dynamics and spheres of communication.
So what's the political content, so to speak, or the message, especially in terms of the redistribution of power, of income, of dignity, as people feel it at the community level?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, one of the slogans of the community media people is popular power is local power. And I think that this is really important, because too often there's these grand schemes and there's, you know, these ideas that, oh, we can create all these broad regional alliances. And yet what the community media people are saying is, if we're going to build a movement and it's going to be somewhat autonomous, it has to be based in our communities and our lives. And I think that's exactly what community radio is helping to do. It's helping to, create a nucleus between different movements, create a nucleus between different communities, and allow people to kind of have a point of interface. The community media collectives themselves are run by assembly, so that you'll have some of them, the bigger ones, have popular assemblies in the morning and in the evening where they bring together everybody and they put questions to the assembly. And so there's all these working through of new forms of democratic decision-making that is also, I feel, very central to how this is working.
But what does it have to do with everybody's image of Hugo Chavez at the UN smelling the very devil in the aftermath of George Bush's appearance?
Well, it has a couple of things to do with it. One it has to do with is that these people, I believe, are the ones who are keeping Chavez in power. I mean, during the elections, during the recall referendum, especially during the coup of 2002 when the opposition kicked him out of office, these networks were extremely important in mobilizing and gathering people and bringing them out into the streets. If it was up to Chavez's party, the MVR, you know, a lot of people have said, you know, he wouldn't be in power anymore. It's because of these semi-autonomous networks of people who really believe strongly that Chavez should be their representative in the electoral sphere. And they only see the electoral sphere as one sphere of many, many spheres of politics in which they're involved. But in the electoral sphere, Chavez should be their representative. And it's they're the ones who've gone knocking door to door, who've campaigned for him, who've worked really hard to continue to have him elected time and time again. And that's what I feel they're doing. I mean, on the second hand, they do have some influence, and this is, you know, through broader media associations such as AMCLA, which bring together urban and rural sectors, which bring together and unite large numbers of community media, actually allows them to have some kind of influence in terms of policy making and what Chavez is doing.
Don't go away, Sujatha. Thomas Panaya teaches social theory and globalization. He's in the thick of this conference, too. Thomas, we say sometimes the only serious question among adults is, what are you going through? What is Latin America going through?
Well, following on what Sujatha was saying, there's a kind of revolution in how we imagine progress and how we imagine the self, our role in progress. Over the last 25 years in Latin America, there's the ideology and policies that have been imposed on Latin America have emphasized the market. The free market will solve all your problems, and that itself was emerging out of a criticism of a previous state-led model of progress. Well, today in Latin America, as Sujatha was pointing out, there's a conception that progress is something that has to emerge from the public as a whole. And it has to emerge from a deeper, more participatory democracy, that people shouldn't be represented, that progress shouldn't be left to the hands of CEOs and politicians, but in fact, people should represent themselves, that they should somehow be the engine of progress. People should be their own leaders. And so there's a different conception of the self then that comes with that. Instead of seeing the self as a kind of autonomous unit that, you know, engages with the market or engages with politicians through votes, the self is actually interdependent with the community around them, and even interdependent not only with the community, but even interdependent in some ways with nature, with the world around them. And so this is a very different model in terms of this is happening at a kind of sub-global, sub-national level. This idea that the public should be allowed to directly decide for itself the direction of development.
You remind me of the line attributed to Joseph Stiglitz that we should be measuring gross domestic happiness, not the gross domestic product.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Like,
which idea comes first?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. We've always thought of development in terms of raising living standards. How do we redistribute goods and services so that our gross domestic so that the human development index should increase. But in fact, what's interesting in Latin America is this new emphasis on well-being. What is our relationship to people around us and the world around us? So that's a bit different emphasis. It's an emphasis like what constitutes happiness? Is it more and more consumption? Or is it actually a different way of perceiving the world, a different way of interacting with the world and each other?
Who invented this idea? Who do you associate with championing it?
I don't think it's one person. I think that the emergence of the indigenous movement as being a very powerful movement in Latin America has definitely had an impact on it. But I think it's also a response to past state-led and market-led strategies for development. Because when you start to criticize those two, what's left is the broader public. And what is that public looking for? And I think they're looking for something different in Latin America right now. I mean, for sure, the World Social Forum, the global justice movements, these movements have had a huge impact on Latin America. And they're much more oriented around culture, identity, self-expression, and collective expression, rather than simply focused on how do we increase product, how do we consume more, how do we raise living standards? So, I mean, it's not that these movements are against raising living standards, but they're bringing in another layer, a deeper layer, that has to also be addressed.
You mentioned the indigenous movement. We keep feeling that this is the kind of unopened secret door of the whole story of a what we would call Indian, pre-Columbian spirit asserting itself in Bolivia, but in Latin America in general.
Yeah, well, in Bolivia for sure, but then across the region, there's the Andean Initiative, which is indigenous movements networking together. I think if we imagined the focus was on redistribution, how do we redistribute resources, redistribute income? I think the focus now is much more on recognition. How do we recognize people's identities? You know, the world around us is impermanent. But our identity, our experience is a little more permanent, our experience of ourself. And so people asking to be recognized, recognize me for who I am. Don't impose some template down from the IMF or the World Bank onto me. And so I think because it's focused around identity and ecology, I think those are things that indigenous movements have obviously a longer history than most cultures. And so there's a kind of release of all these suppressed identities that have been suppressed, you know, not only over the last 30 years, but for hundreds of years. And so I think that's maybe the role that the indigenous movements are playing in helping reshape how we imagine development, how we imagine progress.
Can you imagine how we North Americans are going to answer that question? How do we see these people in a new way?
We ourselves are doing it. Within North America, at a much smaller level, we ourselves, there's a massive criticism right now of consumerism. There's a great concern around climate change. These are criticisms not just of George Bush. These are broader criticisms of a whole system, a system of life that just isn't working. People feel depleted by it. It's depleting the earth. It's depleting our people. So I think this is already incipient emerging in North America already, actually. And you see it everywhere in terms of people's desire for a new way of perceiving the world, a new way of experiencing the world.
Point to the evidence you're thinking about.
Oh, we could just, I mean, it's kind of mundane, but I mean it's not mundane, actually. The alternative health movement. In essence, they're saying that medical science doesn't work, or it's partial. The movement towards, every supermarket now sells organic food. That's a criticism of mainstream science. Yoga centers are full. Buddha centers are full. These are all a search for a different model, a model that isn't oriented simply around rationality, a model that's super rational, that can involve rationality but involves other aspects of the human, more intuitive aspects, spiritual aspects, and that's of course complex. There's a million spiritualities in the world, but looking for something more than this culture that's been ruled by production, efficiency, science. I think that's maybe the key, and that's happening at a much more obvious level in Latin America right now. And that I think is the underlying layer underneath all these political economic changes we're seeing.
I can't yet imagine that Evo Morales is going to mention this when he comes to Brown, but maybe he will.
Well, we were actually talking to the foreign minister of Bolivia, and he told us this. He said, you're focused on living standards, we're focused on well-being. And he said, that's the difference between the indigenous vision and the modern Western vision. So I think Evo Morales might mention it, actually.
This is fascinating. I mean, you're changing the focus from sort of petro-nationalism to a kind of humane and spiritual redefinition of all of our sovereignties. I wonder, Thomas, last word. The United States is going through its own search for change. Can you imagine a convergence here in 2009 of different mentalities?
Not in 2009. Maybe in the long run. But what's interesting in the U.S. is the whole Barack Obama candidacy. It's a very interesting phenomena in terms of asking ourselves, what's the meaning of the electricity surrounding that candidacy? And the meaning of it is, this is what I think the meaning of it is.
Please.
After 7 years of cynical government, the public wants renewal. And that's a great thing. That's a really great thing. Now, I don't think that problem is going to be solved simply by electing an optimistic person into the White House. You know, and in fact, I actually like most of the candidates. I think most of the candidates, they're probably not such evil people. But I think there's a system around them that's going to force them in a certain direction. So I don't see this problem being solved in 2009. But I think that aspiration for renewal is common in Latin America. There's an aspiration for renewal, and where that'll go over the long run will be interesting. So the more we can create opportunities for exchange between people who have that yearning for renewal in North America and Latin America, I think that'll open the door to something greater, and over time. I mean, change is generational. It's not going to happen in a couple of years, but so that's what I would focus on. How do we create more exchange, create more opportunities between those types of people who are searching for something hopeful and new, not the old, something very new, something very different, and something that takes on the totality of the human, the full dimensionality of the human, not just one dimension of our experience.
Thomas Bonilla, this is fascinating, dare I say, encouraging. Sujatha Fernandez from Queen's College, Thomas Bonilla from Harvard, thank you so much. Let the conference continue.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.